body, I think I someone mentioned I hadn't had a chance to look at this, the discussion between Ron Paul and Paul Krugman. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I would say Krugman reminds me of a comment I think was attributed to Oscar Wilde, that he's one of those professors whose ignorance is the product of long study. Now, today, what I want to do is continue. Remember, last time we were mentioning that Murray Rothbard's view of the history of economics is very different from the standard view. But the standard view is economics begins with Adam Smith, and then there's a steady progress since then going down to Lord Keynes in the 20th century and then to his successors, and things have been going steadily upward since economics was founded by Adam Smith in 1776. And Rothbard completely rejects that. He said economics was going long before Adam Smith. Those of you who were in my course on the first volume of Rothbard's book know in what he said about that, that he was mentioning the Spanish scholastics, and he thought that the French economist Turgot and also the Irishman who lived in France, Richard Cantillon, were much better economists than Adam Smith, and he regards Adam Smith as not as the founder of economics, but someone who was introducing a lot of mistakes into economics. So now we continue in today's lecture. In the standard story, the person we'll be talking to about most about today, David Ricardo, is a very crucial person in the history of economics. And just so to be sure we're talking about the same person, we're talking about the 19th century economist David Ricardo, not the character who played on with the character in I Love Lucy, Ricky Ricardo. That's not the person we're talking about. I think I've said before, but shows how old I am, I'm old enough, I remember when I Love Lucy wasn't a rerun, but I'm not so old that I remember when David Ricardo was alive. Now, in the standard picture of economics that Rothbard is challenging, Ricardo's book, which was called Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, is the next great book in economics after The Wealth of Nations. So standard view of economics begins with Wealth of Nations, and then the next great book is Ricardo's book. And why, on the standard view, is this the next great book? Because Ricardo, in this view, established economics as a rigorous science. Adam Smith had all sorts of interesting ideas in Wealth of Nations, but it was a very unsystematic book, and Smith didn't set out his arguments in very rigorous form. By rigorous, I mean in a way where you list all the steps in the argument, you try to get all your, use all your terms precisely, so you can see exactly how your premises are supporting your conclusion. So in standard view, Smith had all sorts of great ideas, but he wasn't very systematic. So Ricardo, in the standard view, is someone who was able to systematize and develop further Smith's insight, and he was really getting economics in a rigorous form. So economics really began as a science. Now, one person, libertarians will be familiar with, who has this view of Ricardo is David Friedman. He regards Ricardo's book, along with Adam Smith, as really the great book of 19th century economics. He regards, in fact, that Ricardo's book is one of the all-time greatest books on economics. It's one of the, if he was listing what are the top two or three books in the history of economics, he would put Ricardo on that list. Now, Rothbard rejects this view of Ricardo, this view that Ricardo is the next great step after Adam Smith. Well, of course, he's going to reject it because he doesn't regard Adam Smith as a great step, but he rejected even leaving Adam Smith out. He doesn't regard Ricardo as making a really major contribution to economics. So you can see how strongly Rothbard is differing from the standard view. It's not only, in his view, the standard view has overestimated some Ricardo somewhat, but they got it completely wrong. Ricardo, according to Rothbard, made really disastrous mistakes, and Ricardian economics is almost all wrong. So he's saying, instead of this Whig interpretation, remember that was the phrase Herbert Butterfield used for the view, where we're evaluating history from the present, we're seeing what leads up to the present, which is regarded as the best state of affairs, and we're saying things are leading up to the present gradually, there's been progress to the present. Rothbard said, no, there can be, if we have the correct doctrine, there can be things aren't always progressing up, haven't progressed up to the correct doctrine just by a series of ever better steps. There have been some steps that have been in the wrong direction. Economics has gone down the wrong path. Now, one of Ricardo's basic mistakes, according to Rothbard, was a way that he differed from Adam Smith. Now, usually, as those of you who read Volume 1 or were in my course on the first volume, you know, Rothbard is saying, Smith, here's way Smith is all wrong, but here's one he was thought Smith was right, because Smith was concerned with how economies grow. Remember, the title is The Wealth of Nations, or an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. So Smith is wanting to know, how does an economy grow? But Ricardo really isn't interested in that very much. What Ricardo wants to know is that how is the income in society distributed in an economy, say, workers will get some part of all the total money in the economy, capitalists will get it some other part, people who own land will get still another part. So what Ricardo wants to know is, how are these various shares assigned to these different factors of production? And he's generally assuming the economy is static, so it isn't changing or not changing very much. He's concerned with how income is distributed rather than how the economy is growing. And Rothbard said, well, that's really a mistake to do that. Now, Rothbard makes even more fundamental criticism of Ricardo, is he doesn't like Ricardo's question of how is the total income of an economic system distributed among the factors of production, land, labor, and capital. So he's not just saying Ricardo's made a mistake in emphasis because he's concentrating on that question rather than Adam Smith's question, how does the economy grow? He doesn't like the question at all. And what is it that he doesn't like about it? Well, he says, if you phrase the question that way, say, how does the economic system distribute income among these facts to production, land, labor, and capital, then you're assuming that there are separate laws of distribution. But in a market economy, which is what Ricardo was dealing with, there aren't separate laws of distribution. The individual will make various decisions about what to produce and what to buy. And once all those decisions are made, that will result in people having money. Say, if I buy something, then the person I buy from will have money, and then if I sell something to someone, I'll have money. So the outcome of all those decisions will determine what the distribution is. But there aren't separate laws independent of production that determine what and how distribution takes place. So this is a basic mistake Ricardo made. Now, why did he make that mistake? Why didn't he see that how income is distributed on the market really flows out of these individual decisions by producers and consumers? Well, the reason for that was he really wasn't much concerned with individual prices or factors of production. So roughly saying what the economist is trying to do is explain individual decisions to produce or consume, and then we can get from that how people or factors of production get their income. But Ricardo isn't concerned with these individual prices. He's just concerned with aggregates, like he's talking about what determines wages, taking wages all together, not an individual wage. So instead of saying, well, this person, say, earns $20 an hour in this job, Ricardo will ask, what determines the price of labor, kind of taking labor as an aggregate, taking labor altogether. So Rothbard thinks that's a really fundamental mistake. So as I say, he objects to the question Ricardo is asking. Ricardo is asking, how is income distributed among rent, wages, and profit or interest? Ricardo takes profit and interest to be really mean the same thing. I think that's sort of a return on capital. He doesn't use the term interest so much for a monetary loan, like how much money you pay on your loan, but he has in mind, like, what is the return you'll get on capital if you invest money in a business? What are you going to get? What's the rate of profit? He thinks there's a standard rate of profit that people will get. So what Ricardo is saying, well, in production, there'll be a total amount, when you take all production together, there'll be a total amount of income that's generated, and some of this will go to the people who own land, others will go to the workers, and some of the money will go to the capitalists. And why does it go to them? Because those are the three factors of production. To produce something, you need some land, you need some resources to work on, you need labor, and in almost all production, you need equipment or tools, so you need land, labor, and capital, and then you have to figure out how much each one gets. So, as I say, Rothbard doesn't like this question because it's taking land, labor, and capital as aggregates rather than asking about how individual prices are determined. It's also assuming there are separate laws of distribution as opposed to just taking distribution as the outcome of these individual decisions by producers and consumers. Now, as you can see, Rothbard isn't too, oh wait, there's a question here, I didn't see it, Steve says, it doesn't focus on the individual versus aggregate, simply a recognition that only individuals act in the real world. That's a good question. Well, I think it certainly flows from methodological individuals and focus on the individuals. It wouldn't follow strictly that somebody could say, well, all individuals act, but it turns out there are laws that you can get just by considering aggregates. That wouldn't be a logical contradiction, because as long as you didn't claim that the aggregates acted. But as Austrian economics actually develops, you're right that the how prices are determined do come from considering individuals and their action. But I don't think you'd say it's strictly logically required that you couldn't have laws about aggregates just follows directly from methodological individualism, because, like I say, you only get a contradiction if you said that the aggregates act, that don't consist of individuals, acted in some way that wasn't reducible to individual action. But that was a good question. Okay, so as we can see, Rothbard doesn't think very much of Ricardo's question, and not only doesn't he like the question, he doesn't like the way he answers it either. How did Ricardo try to answer this question? Well, what he did was he set up a system of mathematical identities, and we'll see how this works in coming up very shortly. And these identities are really tautology. A tautology is something that doesn't really say the same thing. Like, suppose I say a bachelor is an unmarried male of a certain age. I haven't really told you anything new. I've just given a certain definition. I'm just explaining how I use a certain term. So what Rothbard said is, Ricardo just set up this system of tautology, and these don't tell us anything about real causal relation. What we're trying to do in science is figure out how the world works, kind of what causes what in the world. And we can't do this just by setting up a system of tautologies that just say something is identical to something else. That isn't really going to tell us anything. So how did Ricardo do this? Well, he really worked with this identity that total income equals rent, wages, and profit. Rent plus wages and profit. You can see he's right. This is an identity because, remember, those are the factors of production. These are the names of the income of the factors of production. So all income is either rent, wages, or capital, because production takes place by combining land, labor, and capital. So any income would have to go from production has to go to one of those factors. So we know total income equals wage rent plus wages plus profit. So far Ricardo is right, but he's just defining what total income is. He isn't really giving us any causal account of things. So then suppose you would take this equation. Remember, an equation is a statement of identity. The equation, you said, what's on one side of the equation is the same as what's on the other side. So that's why if you change something on one side and you do the same change on the other side, you'll continue to have an identity. So suppose you assume that income and rent don't change. So you can only change wages and profit. So if wages go up, then profit has to go down. And why is that? Well, the income remains the same, and there's been a change in wages. Wages have gone up, So since the income, since both sides have to be the same, income is the same, wages have gone up, then either rent or profit or both have to go down. And if we're assuming rents stay the same, then profit has to go down. But that isn't giving us a causal relation. That isn't saying that wages are doing something that forces profits down. It just comes about just because of this mathematical identity, that it's given that since total income equals rent plus wages plus profit, and rent doesn't change in a total, if wages go up, total income stays the same, rent doesn't change, so profit has to go down. It's simply a mathematical identity. Now, besides objections, we have to consider, when we're looking at Rothbard's objections or the details, or the way, before we get to the details of Rothbard's objections, the details of Ricardo's thesis, we have to consider an objection. And this wouldn't be to what Rothbard said about Ricardo. We could ask, the objection is, maybe what Rothbard is saying would also invalidate Austrian economics. Danny mentions that there's identity equation exchange, the arithmetic identity. Yes, that's a good point. I mean, Mises in Theory, Money, and Credit has some good criticisms of the use of the equation exchange. Okay, so what is the objection we might give? So Rothbard is saying Ricardo is reasoning this kind of mathematical deductive way, just deducing certain things that are true because they follow from mathematical identity. But the objection is, doesn't Austrian praxeology reason in the same way? Austrian praxeology is a deductive science also. So if Rothbard is saying, well, look, Ricardo isn't giving you a genuine causal account of the world, he's just giving you a system of mathematical tautology, it isn't really telling you anything, couldn't you give the same criticism of praxeology? And in fact, you couldn't, because Austrian economics doesn't rely on arbitrary axioms or just identities. It's interested in causal relations, what takes place in the world, like there are really actions taking place in the world. Then we just ask, what are the properties of these? So in Austrian economics, we're not concerned with elaborating tautologies, we're concerned with real events, actions that happen in the world. Okay, so given Ricardo's equation, remember we have total income equals rent plus wages plus profit. So to understand the system, obviously we have to understand what he thinks determines rent, wages, and profit, because those are the three things that make up total income. So now, on wages, we have to first realize he accepts Malthus on population. Thomas Malthus was a friend of his. They sometimes differed, especially on Say's Law, but they were very good friends and they agreed on many things. So what Malthus famously said was that population tends to increase faster than food supply. And in fact, that population, in his view, will always be pressing on the food supply. So given a certain food supply, population will tend to increase until it reaches the maximum that can be supported by at that level of food production. So given a certain, if food production gets better, we can produce more food, then we can support more people. And of course, people need food in order to live, so we have to be able to produce enough food for people to live. But suppose agricultural production increases, so then in Malthus's view, people don't just say, well, in general, don't just say, that's fine, now we'll all have more to eat, but they'll start reproducing more, so they'll then press on the food supply until you have the most people that can be supported given that food supply. I see I've made a typo in my, I think the next slide, I said casual relations rather than causal relations. We'll get to that. So Ricardo accepted this, and what he said was, well, what happens if wages go up, if people are able to buy more food, then population will increase, because if they have, they're able to buy more food, then remember, they'll have more food available to them, so population, according to Malthus, will go up because people keep reproducing until they reach the maximum that can be supported by that amount of food. So what happens if you have more people? Well, this drives down wages, because if you have more workers there, more people, then this, you have a greater supply of labor. We know if the supply of anything increases, then other things being equal, its price will go down. So what happens when population increases, and wages will go down. So if wages rise, then people will be able to buy more food, and then people reproduce more, so it'll push wages down. Now, wages can't go below subsistence because, look, if people can't eat, then they're not going to be able to work. So there's a bottom to wages. There's a subsistence rate. Wages can't go below that, but they can't go much above that, because if they do, then they'll just be more workers. Workers will increase, the population will increase, and then wages will go back down again. So in Ricardo's system, then, wages are really fixed. They're fixed at the subsistence level. They can't go, obviously, go below that, and they can't go much above that either. Sometimes you could get wages rising temporarily, but they're not going to be able to stay very much above subsistence. Now, by subsistence, should be mentioned, Ricardo didn't mean bare physical survival. I think people have worked out that if you survive physically, you don't really need that much money. Like, people could just live in a barrel and just eat the minimum required to live. But generally in a society, there's kind of an accepted standard of living of what people need. And Ricardo himself mentions in the principle, let's say, what the worker in England in his time would need might be much more than what, say, workers in other countries would need, because that's kind of the common standard of living. Now, Rothbard doesn't accept this, because what if you object to it? He says that what this is assuming is it's kind of a mechanical relation between population and wages. He said whenever wages go up, population goes up, because people just react. They say, well, we have more money, so now we can reproduce more. There's no thought process involved. And in fact, Rothbard believes that people could just have a choice about it. They could say, well, we have more money now, so what are we going to do with it? They don't have to just say, okay, well, now we've got more money, so we better start reproducing. If people don't act that way, they sometimes will decide we'd rather have a higher standard of living and not reproduce. So Rothbard rejects that view, but Ricardo accepted it. Now, Since the wages depend on the food available, because workers are getting a subsistence wage, but the crucial factor in determining wages is how much does food cost, because workers have to be able to buy enough food in order to for subsistence, but their wages aren't going to rise much higher than that. And we've already explained why. If the wages were higher than that, then more people would just start reproducing. This would increase the supply of labor. So what the basic thing in determining how high wages are, how high is the cost of food. Now when Ricardo, he's talking about the cost of food, remember he aggregates commodities instead of saying, well, what is the cost, thinking of what are the different items that the food that workers eat. He'll just take all food in general, as if it's just one commodity, and he talks about the price of corn when he discusses the cost of food. Now, by corn, he doesn't mean what we in America, those of you who are in America, mean, like a certain kind of food, yellow thing with yellow with all sorts of kernels on. That would be called in England, I think, Indian corn. But corn means wheat, so he's really talking about the price of wheat, but he calls it the price of corn. Now, suppose the price of corn rises, then wages also have to rise. And why is that? Well, because remember, workers need to get a subsistence wage, so they have to have enough corn to eat, and if the price of corn rises, then they have to get more money to be able to buy the amount of corn they need in order to subsist. So, and here's something we talked about a little bit before, we can see more detail on that. Remember, Ricardo's equation, remember, total income equals rent plus wages plus profit. So remember, this is one of Rothbard's criticisms, he's considering really a static system, a basically static system, which total income stays the same. So supposing the price of corn has gone up, so wages have gone up, so something else has to go down. So then, well, what could go down? It has to be either rent or profit. So, as we'll see, very soon, Ricardo thought that rent wouldn't go down, so only profit is left. So if wages rise, profit falls. So wages and profit are an inverse relation. If wages were to go down, profits would go up, because we can see the same sort of reasoning. Rent doesn't change, so if income stays the same, wages go down, profits would go up. But that isn't as important, that phenomenon of wages going down, profits going up. And you can see why that is, because remember we've already mentioned wages can't really go down that much, because they're pretty much at the subsistence level, and they can't go below subsistence. So the most important thing to think about is what happens if wages rise. I mean, they could go above subsistence, then, although Ricardo thinks they're not going to stay very highly above subsistence because people keep reproducing, but if wages rise, then profits will fall. And why is that? Again, this is simply an arithmetic identity, because we're saying total income equals rent plus wages and profit, and we're assuming total income stays the same, rent stays the same. So if wages go up, then profits go down. Otherwise, we wouldn't preserve the equality for that has to be present for each side of the equation. So that's why wages rise, profits fall. Now, probably the most distinctive element in Ricardo's system is his account of rent, which is how much that you, what determines the price of using land. So what Ricardo points out is that the land in a given economic system will vary in how productive it is. Wait, I just see there's a question. Let me just go to that. Mike has said, the answer seems to be there's no reason the employer would ever pay labor more than was needed to cover his bare subsistence. Remember, you could get, in Ricardo's system, you could get different kinds of labor, like some workers would get, you do more skilled work than others, and they would earn more money. But remember, Ricardo isn't interested very much in particular wages, like how much do professors get or how much do doctors get. He's interested in just wages in general. So he's just talking about really the basic kind of unskilled labor. These other things, more skilled labor, would just be kind of exceptions. What he's trying to do is turn wages kind of taken as an aggregate. And he says these would be at the subsistence level. Remember, when we talk about subsistence, it isn't really the minimum physical requirement, it's sort of what the kind of, there's an element of social custom involved. So this could also be a way where you could get different wages for different jobs. But basically, he's concerned just with kind of taking labor as an aggregate. But getting back to land, so he said land varies in how productive it is. Some land is much more productive. You can grow crops much better. You can get many more crops, say, from really good soil than you could from poor soil. So he thinks people will first use the most productive land that they can find. And when that's all taken, people go on to the next most productive. Something like you're starting off, you'll say, well, what's the best land available? So I'm going to get that. Then they'll keep, if that's taken, then you go on to the next. And as population increases, less and less productive land is used because the best land is all taken. Then you get more people, they'll use best land available, which is not as good as what's already taken, and this process will go on. So less and less productive land is used as production increases. So if supposing a type of land is more productive than another type, then all the gains go to the landlord. Say, supposing you're a farmer and you're renting land from the landlord, and say you've got a more productive amount, better land, say, than your neighbor had, so you're able to grow more crops than he is. So it doesn't, according to Ricardo, it doesn't mean you're going to earn more income than the neighbor. He said the landlord is going to charge you more to take, he'll be able to take all of the increase that you would get, all of the surplus that you would get over this, your neighbor whose land isn't as productive. So all the surplus from having better land goes to the landlord. So the user of productive land doesn't get any benefit from using it. It all goes to the landlord. And Ricardo thinks that land, people keep appropriating land or using land until the point of zero surplus goes to the landlord. So imagine people keep saying, well, we're going to, what's the best land available? they'll take that and they say the next people have to take the next most productive land. And they'll keep doing this until they get to land that doesn't yield any surplus to the landlord. People will just get there. Because remember, rent comes in Ricardo's view from getting a differential. You get rent if you're more productive than some other land. So you get a differential is rent. But if you got to the least productive land in use at a given time, there isn't going to be any rent because rent is a differential. So there's nothing below the least productive land being used. So that's why there's no rent in Ricardo's system. So what happens, you know, we've explained now how wages, the term wages are determined, remember taking wages in aggregate, by the price of corn, because that's what determines the subsistence rate, and rent, you get that from differential productivity of land. Some land is better than others, so the differential is rent. So you've got those two, we know what determines them. So what happens once you take out rent and wages? Well, remember, we've got the identity, total income equals rent plus wages and profit. So if rent and wages are taken out, then what's left is profit, because that's what the identity says. Total income equals rent plus wages plus profit. So after you subtract rent and wages, what's left is profit. And Ricardo considers profit a residual. He doesn't think there are separate laws, say, of what determines the rate of profit on capital, just that that's what's left after you take out rent and wages. So, as I mentioned before, as more and more land comes under cultivation, it becomes harder to grow corn because you're using less productive land. And remember, workers can't get a wage below subsistence, so wages are going up because they have to cover the cost of subsistence, which has gone up. And this increase comes entirely at the expense of the capitalist. Landlords don't give up anything, as is what we mentioned before. So as I said, profit and wages are inversely related. Now what we're adding on this slide is there's a tendency for wages to rise. So what we're doing is combining what we said before. Remember, profit and wages are inversely related because rent doesn't change and income doesn't change. Remember, we said so rent is the same and income is the same. So if wages go up, then profit has to go down. So we're adding what we said before, we have this hypothetical. If wages go up, then profits will go down. Now we're saying there is a tendency for wages to rise. So it's not only if wages go up, profits will go down. We're saying wages will go up, or tend to go up, so profit tends to go down. So Ricardo says there's a long-term trend for profit to fall. So this is what he thinks. He thinks this is a law of economics, because there's a long-term trend for profits to fall. And this is carried over into Marxism as well. Now, Rothbard doesn't accept this view. Remember, he's rejected this whole notion, this whole method of reasoning by this use of mathematical identity. But he thinks that even once you've got the identity, what Ricardo says about how rent and wages, profits are determined, isn't right either. Remember, we already gave his criticism of how wages are determined. He said he's assuming that wages are just at a subsistence level because he assumes kind of mechanical relationship between increase in wages and growth in population, and he's wrong, according to Rothbard, he's wrong to assume that. But Rothbard also thinks that Ricardo's theory of rent is especially vulnerable to criticism. And one thing I have to remember, in Ricardo's system, suppose you have a certain land, we're calling land A, so what does the rent, what is the rent, how is rent for that land A determined? According to Ricardo, it's differential productivity from other land. So Rothbard said, why should we say land is just payment for differential productivity? It has a, it would have a pay, of course, Ricardo's right, that more productive land would get, command a higher price than less productive land. That's fairly obviously true, but why should we assume there's, isn't a value for land just for being able to use the land at all? Why is it only land that's more productive than some other land that has a price? Let's say we have sort of the least productive land. Every other class of land is more productive than this. This would still command a price, because after all, you're able to produce something on it. So you would have, if you wanted to cultivate that land, you'd have to pay for it. And if you actually had land that had no return at all, it wouldn't be cultivated. So any land is going to have some return, and then that land would earn a price. So Ricardo's wrong to think that rent is just a differential. Then another problem in Ricardo's theory is, supposing, let's say there's a case where a farmer is using land of superior productivity, so he has to pay more for the land. So Ricardo just assumes the landlord can get all the gains of the superior productivity, but why is that right? I mean, there's, it seems like there's room for bargaining there between landlords and people who use the land, but Ricardo is just assuming that all the gains go to the landlord. And another problem is Ricardo thinks, he says, well, people start off historically with the most productive land, then they go on to the least productive land. But that isn't always the case. They had a choice between using more productive, less productive land. They presume the other thing being equal, taking more productive land. But it doesn't always work out that people always take the most productive land first, then go on to the next most productive, and so on. So Ricardo's just made an arbitrary assumption about how people use land. Now, so far what we've been explaining is Ricardo's views about the distribution of income. So we're saying how, again, we're taking total income, then we're taking these aggregates, rent, wages, and profit. We're saying what determines what share of total income goes to each one. But we haven't explained so far what accounts for the price of individual goods. Remember, Ricardo was just talking about these aggregates so far, rent, wages, and profit. Now, what about what accounts for individual prices? Now, the most obvious thing you would think before going to economic theory is changes in demand and supply. Like if the supply of something goes up, price would tend to fall. If demand goes up, the price would tend to rise. This kind of, people don't really need economic theory to know this. And Ricardo accepted that, that change in demand and supply could affect prices, but he thought change in demand and supply are really superficial. They would cause prices to fluctuate temporarily, but in the long run, the price of something would be determined by the labor hours required to make it. I exempted certain goods, like certain goods are just kind of unique, like artworks, they're just one of a kind, but for goods that are reproducible, there we have a lot of them, which are the great majority of goods in the economy, what determines the price on them is the number of labor hours required to make it. So then, well, you'd have to, you have something like takes 10 hours, say, to make a table. Well, 10 hours isn't a price, so you'd have to convert this to a money price, and how you did that would depend on the quantity of money. So to get the price, it wouldn't be just the labor hours, but you'd have to add some rate of profit to it, which is kind of takes to become the standard rate of profit in the economy. So you add the profit to the monetary conversion of the number of labor hours, and that gives you the price. And you might say, well, what happens to rent? Rent isn't part of the price because, remember, rent, production always goes to the point at which there is zero rent being paid. So rent is always zero at the margin. So you people who have to pay rent couldn't charge more because they have to pay rent, because they wouldn't be able to charge more than the going rate for the commodity. So rent isn't part of the price. That just comes out of profits. I mean, that comes out of that goes to the landlord, but it doesn't figure into the price. So the price is the labor hours plus this profit rate. So since the profit rate is just a small percent of the total, really the biggest determinant of price is the number of labor hours. Now, the problem in this theory is that you have to figure out the number of labor hours. You have to figure out how to equate labor of different kinds of skill. For example, how would the labor of a surgeon be equated to the labor of a ditch digger? Because the labor of a surgeon would be more valuable. So you have to figure out some way of saying labor of a surgeon equals this many hours of labors of a ditch digger. So that's a big problem for labor, this labor theory of value. And it's also a problem in Marx's theory, that since he has a labor theory of value. Now, Ricardo strictly doesn't have a labor theory of value, remember, because he's adding this profit rate, but this is still a big problem for it. Now, you might say, well, why didn't Ricardo just explain prices as the Austrians do? I say prices depend on utility. Price depends on how much people value the good as compared with how they value other goods, not on the labor required to produce the good. Well, Ricardo didn't really have much of a place for utility. He acknowledged that if a good didn't have utility, it couldn't command a positive price. For example, suppose somebody spends a lot of time making mud pies. He likes making mud pies, spend hours and hours of labor on them. He wouldn't be able to get money for these based on his labor hours because no one would want the mud pies. But Ricardo thought once people do want something, once it has utility, then it passes the test for a good to have a positive price. But after it passes that test, after it has utility, then utility doesn't enter into what the price is. It's a necessary condition for having a positive price at a good half utility, but once it passes that test, then price is determined by, not by utility, but by number of labor hours required to produce it plus the profit rate. Now, so far we've been criticizing Ricardo a lot, saying how terrible Ricardo is, he's all wrong. But is there anything good to say about Ricardo? Does Rothbard have anything good to say about it? Well, one thing he was right about was he accepted Say's law. Remember, we were talking about Say's law last time. And Say's law denies that there can be general overproduction. Sometimes people will say, well, we're in a depression because the level of spending isn't enough to generate full employment. Total spending can't really sustain the level of production that we want for full employment. But according to Say's law, total production can't exceed total spending and saving because this total, it just is total production. When, say, you imagine this is clear in a barter economy, what, say, one person's demand for a certain commodity is just what he himself produces. So goods are being exchanged for one another. So basically production and spending plus saving are the same thing, really. So one can't be more than the other. And critics of Say's law say, well, once you introduce money, that changes everything, because then people can just start hoarding money. We can have gaps between production and spending. But according to Say, money really doesn't change matters. And Ricardo thinks Say was right. So, and of course, Rothbard accepts Say's law too. But Rothbard really doesn't give Ricardo that much credit for accepting this. He said he really got this from his friend James Mill. So it was really Mill who told him about Say's law. He was really just saying whatever what Mill had said. He wasn't coming up with anything really original. Now, usually, what's called the law of comparative cost or law of comparative advantage is taken to be one of Ricardo's greatest achievements. Now, what is this? Well, supposing we have two people, A and B, given, of course, you know, people don't usually have names that are just letters of the alphabet, but in this example, like, people would just calling them that. So suppose A is better in growing oranges than B, and B is better in growing than A is in growing apples. So it seems obvious A and B together will produce more oranges than apples combined if each one specializes in what he can do best, and then they can trade with each other. That's pretty straightforward. But what would happen if A is better than B in growing both apples and oranges? So let's say B is pretty incompetent and can't really do very much. So is there, somebody might think, well, then it is, why would A have any benefit from trading with B if he can produce whatever B does better himself? Wouldn't it be better off just producing things by himself? So what the law of comparative cost says is that trade is still advantageous if one party is absolutely better at producing everything than the other. And what the better producer should concentrate on producing is the product in which he enjoys the greatest amount of superiority. And the worst producer should concentrate on producing the product where his margin of inferiority is least. So this is a really basic point, because he says trade can take place even between people who are worse at producing everything than other people. So everybody benefits from trade. It's not just that it's good for the ones who are not very good to produce. They'd be obviously happy to trade with people who are better producers than they are. But it's also advantageous for the ones who are better producers. So this is a really fundamental law. Now, again, I think we can see from lectures, Rothbard doesn't think very highly of Ricardo. So what's he going to do? He said, well, looks like Ricardo's come up with a really good contribution. So could Rothbard say anything against that? Well, what he says is very interesting in finding some good angles. He says, sure, Ricardo's right, but in fact, Ricardo really didn't care much about comparative advantage. It was, again, he just had a few pages on it in Principles of Political Economy. He didn't really care much. And it was really James Mill who developed the law. Now, Rothbard regards James Mill, who was the father of the more famous John Stuart Mill, whom we'll be talking about in a later lecture. He was a very interesting character. He was a very tough personality, primarily an organizer. He organized a political reform movement. He got Ricardo together with Jeremy Bentham, who we'll be talking about very shortly. And Rothbard calls him a cadre type, kind of someone who's able to build up a political party in comparison with the Russian revolutionary Lenin. So he said Mill was kind of a good organizer, very important in this political radical movement who people wanted reform. And his contributions to economic theory tended to be underestimated because Mill didn't place much stress on his own originality. He was trying to promote Ricardo and also Jeremy Bentham, but he himself made contributions. So Rothbard said it wasn't really Ricardo developed this law of comparative cost, it was really James Mill. Now Rothbard does give Ricardo credit for his opposition to high taxes and to government intervention, that Ricardo basically favored the free market. So Rothbard does have at least that something good to say about it. Now just in passing, I should mention, Mises generalized Ricardo law into a law, what he called the law of association, and this is very important part of human action. What Mises says is that everyone benefits through social cooperation on the free market. Now, I want to say a little bit, I thought the most important thing to do in this lecture is to talk about Ricardo, because he's the one who, in the conventional picture, is absolutely central to the development of economics. And he's really the great systematizer of classical economics, and Rothbard, so seeing why Rothbard criticizing it's really fundamental to understanding this whole volume of Rothbard's book and understanding his whole conception of the history of economics. But we want to ask also, why does Rothbard include a chapter about Jeremy Bentham in the book? After all, it's the history of economics. So why put in a chapter about Bentham, who was primarily a legal theorist and philosopher? Now it's true, Bentham wrote about economics. He had a famous book on usury where he opposed having maximum interest rates, although as Rothbard points out, he changed his mind somewhat later. But he wrote a little bit about economics, somewhat about economics, but he wasn't a major theorist. So why have a chapter about him in a book on history of economic theory? So the reason Rothbard discusses him is that he thinks Bentham's utilitarianism was basic to classical economics, and he doesn't like Bentham's utilitarianism. Now, I should say, when we talk about utilitarianism here, what he's attacking, it's different from the views of Mises and Henry Hazlitt, who are also utilitarian. So I think basically what Mises means when he talks about utilitarianism is he's talking about asking questions. Why do we have what rules of morality? What are rules of morality for? And Mises saying, well, rules of morality aren't just dictate something like we have to do, you must do this, don't ask why, this is what morality says. Mises says rules of morality aim to promote human welfare, and he thinks that the free market, the cooperation through the free market, social cooperation, is the best way to promote human welfare. I think this is basically what he means by utilitarianism. So I don't think that's what Rothbard is aiming to attack. It isn't that Rothbard thinks sort of rules of morality aren't aimed at promoting human welfare, but he wants to attack the specific system of Jeremy Bentham, and so he's not really disagreeing with Mises and Hazlitt, although he does have some disagreements with them, but he's really attacking Bentham. But so what he says is what Bentham wants to do is to add up pleasures and pains, like people will get pleasure from certain things, pains from other things. So what Bentham wants to do is say, we add up total amount of pleasures and pains, and that tells us what's good or bad. In famous slogan, is the greatest happiness or the greatest number. There's a question here. Bentham make any important contribution to interest theory that defends the user? Well, Rothbard says he hints at times at a time preference theory of saying that people get interest because they're advancing money now rather than waiting in the future. But he doesn't really develop that in any detail, just sort of possibly hints at it. So he really couldn't be considered a major contributor to interest theory. He had some ideas that were good ideas about it, but he didn't really develop it. So I say there are all sorts of criticism one can give of utilitarianism, but I'll just mention one which is kind of standard one you all think of as well. You can't add up people's pleasures and pain. Kind of another one that's interesting that Rothbard mentioned, that one that maybe you wouldn't think of right away, is that he says, well, what if people's pleasures and pains depend on their moral views? Like, what suppose you think, say, that it's wrong for people to believe in the false religion, so it gets you very upset when you see people engaging in what you take to be idolatry. So there your pain is dependent in part on your moral views, but what are you trying to do in utilitarianism is really explain the moral views by pleasures and pain, but in part the pleasures and pain could depend on the moral views. So Rothbard thinks that's a big problem for utilitarianism. I'm interested in that judgment because I once wrote a short article about how John Stuart Mill wanted to handle that. So I thought it's not the objection you think of right away, but it was one kind of interesting objection that Rothbard mentioned. Well, I think I've gone a bit over time, so I think I'll stop now. Just the question. Gang said, I read somewhere that Bentham was proud of converting Adam Smith with his pro-usury article just before the latter died. Now, that's interesting, although, it's interesting, Bentham later changed his mind himself as Rothbard, so he was willing to allow some laws, some usury laws toward the end, because he tended to be think that he kind of abandoned his laissez-faire views as he got older. But so it's interesting, so he converted Adam Smith, and then he change of mind somewhat. Okay, well, I think the rest of the time we can have for questions, objections, anything you'd like to ask. I'll open the Q&A also, but you can put your question either in the chat or the Q&A, whatever you like. Let me just get the chat also here. Okay. Oh, wait, someone has something here. Anthony says, I just got Resurrecting Marks in the mail today. Can't wait to read it. Sorry if that's not on topic. Well, if you're saying you can't wait to read my book, it certainly doesn't matter if it's off topic. You're very good you say that. I mean, why do we have to be on topic? On topic, especially with something good about me. They think I'm kidding. It says, is your article on Mill and Moral Values available online? I don't think so. I have to check on that. It came out many years ago in British Journal of Political Science. I don't mean a journal of political science that was published in Britain, but that's mainly the journal, British Journal of Political Science. And question, have you seen Bentham's mummified body? No, I've seen pictures of the body, but not the body. Someone once, you know, they were preserved in London School of Economics. I think there was some incident where some students stole the head and used it as a football for a while before it was recovered. Just imagine kicking Bentham in the head. Now, one thing interesting Rothbard points out, he places a lot of stress on what Bentham's project called the Panopticon. This is a prison Bentham devised where all of the cells would be visible to the warden. There would be kind of a system of mirrors where people couldn't tell where the warden was looking, so everybody would be under constant observation. And Rothbard points out he wanted to extend this, so it would be kind of a system of concentration camps where people were, they'd be under observation, kind of prefiguring Orwell's 1984, you know, with Big Brother is watching you. And unfortunately, we're developing some things like that in contemporary society, you know, we have cameras looking at you all the time. I might have said, imagine if you didn't have two-fifths of the British population in it. Yes, he wasn't, according to, he wasn't such a, and he had certain dictatorial ambition. And he considered George III his great enemy because George III wouldn't back his project, so he thought this shows George III is a personal enemy. Now, Steve says, they've often very largely intuitive regrets. How is it that non-economics and Keynes reject it? Well, what Keynes thought is, once you introduce money, that'll change things, because then, say, you say, well, instead of saying that you can't have a real general, a difference between this total demand and total supply, you can have leakages because people will take their money and just kind of put it in a mattress or not spend it, so you could have violations of Say's law. Now, what the reply to that is, well, that would just change the purchasing power of the remaining money. So defenders of Say's law, like William W.H. Hutt, say that doesn't change things. Okay, now here's a question on rent. Louis says, so one major flaw that in Ricardo's view on differential rent might be that they could become negative as land gets less and less productive. No, in Ricardo's system, you couldn't have negative rent because, remember, rent is just the differential you get rent if you have more productive land than somebody else. So the least productive land doesn't get any rent because it's, there's no land that it's more productive than. It's the lowest that you've gotten to. So it, what, you couldn't have negative rent. You would just have land that's less productive than others, and you've got a bottom level. Let me see, what's this one? Matt says, I believe Riesman combined some of the insights of Ricardo with Austrian economics. Is Riesman a supporter of any of the parts of Ricardo's theory that were brought by Chris? Does he promote different areas of Ricardo's thought? Well, what he doesn't really support the parts of Ricardo that Rothbard was most concerned to attack. Where what Riesman takes from Ricardo, he thinks that theory of value that stresses utility can be reconciled in large part with one that stresses cost of production. The details of that are in his book. So he thinks that Ricardian, the Ricardian value theory has something to be said for it. And he also is very concerned with how he thinks, remember I was talking about what Ricardo said, law tends to fall rate of profit to fall so recently, devotes a great deal of attention to how a capitalist system can cope with that tendency and how it can counteract it. But the details of his system are very complicated, but he was very concerned with that. I think Mises, he did this as a his work was in a dissertation under Mises' direction. I think Mises didn't agree with the way what Riesman was doing, but he still supported him anyway. Now, A.L. Spence says, in the era which we were discussing, the great thing is belief that for someone to gain, someone had to lose. No, remember, in this law of comparative cost, we're saying everybody benefits from the trade, so that would be denying that trade is a zero-sum game, that for someone to gain, someone has to lose. Now, certainly if there's zero-sum, it would be saying more than if someone gains, someone loses. It's saying the sum of the gains and losses is zero, but that would not be true for Ricardo or Benton. They would recognize people could benefit from James, because they recognize people could benefit from trade, and they're really developing that idea to say you can benefit from trade not only if you're exchanging something with someone who produces something better than you can, but you can benefit, even the one who's the better producer can benefit from trading with someone who isn't as good at producing as he would be. Okay, let's see what else we have. Okay, I gave that out now. Danny says, how is it the law of association can create a physical product to be two different goods? In Mises' explanation of the law, ends up, for example, an output of 32p plus 45q without division of labor, and 24p plus 60q with division of labor. Under division of labor, there are more q but fewer p. In spite of that, Mises says, that division of labor output can be said to be greater than the isolated output because of substitution ratios. What does he mean by that? Well, I think what he means is, okay, let's say, we say in your example, we have 24P plus 60Q, so we have 32P plus 45Q in the other one. Well, supposing what we did was we took some of the Q, the 60P, and said people had that, we're trying to get some of the Q, we're trying to get trade that in for once they had to total out, but they were trying to trade that in for the most, for a certain amount of P. So what he's saying is before they reached, got to 45Q, you're imagining they're trading off the Qs, trying to get Ps for them, for the Q. So before they got down to 45Q, they come up with more than 32P. So that, I think what it would mean by substitution ratios, you'd be able, if you traded one for the other, you'd be able to get more of the P's and the Q's. So I think that's what he means. I have to go over the passage to be sure, but I think that's what he means by substitution ratio. What you'd have to do to get one, given that you have one, what you'd have to do to get the other, you see. So you don't have to say, it wouldn't be, you have, you know, if you just took them statically and said, well, why is 32P plus 45Q more than 24P plus 60Q. You couldn't see that just from taking it statically. Well, what happens if you try to get P's by exchanging Q's? You'd come up with more. You'd be able to come up with a one plus the other where you'd have more of one, say, the same with the other. So you could see one is unequivocally more. And now Steve says, would Rothbard have felt the basic problem with Ricardo's system with the total income equation? No, because total income equation is true. I mean, it's just a tautology. Tautologies, whatever their failings, are all true. So I think the basic problem with studying, trying to derive a great part of the economic system from that equation just by operating in terms of mathematical manipulations of that equation rather than concentrate on what determines individual prices, you see. But it wasn't that the total income equation is wrong. Now, Hossein says, isn't it true the total income reduction of society is constant, not considering the progress of productivity? Yes, that's right, but the problem isn't that, according to Rothbard, isn't that Ricardo thought that, but he thought that was the wrong thing to concentrate on. You shouldn't just consider a static economy and ask how aggregate distribution takes place. But it isn't that Ricardo was making false statements. He's just asked, at least in that aspect of the thought, he's just asking the wrong questions, not questions that aren't as useful as other ones that might be asked. Okay, let's see something else here. Would you kindly expound on the Mandeville fallacy mentioned in the reading? And she says, I will have difficulty attending the live session. What is the best way to have my question and say for capturing the archive? Well, I think the second part is easy to answer. There's a discussion forum, so you can just post, which is on the course website, you can just post your questions to the discussion forum. Now, the Mandeville fallacy is would be kind of, as I remember it, I may be misremembering the passage, but Mandeville had a famous as a private vice's public benefit. So what Mandeville was saying was something like spending on consumption and luxury goods is a really good thing. We don't need to be concerned much with saving and capital accumulation. It's sort of spending is really good, and if the government, I mean, would lead to the view, I don't know whether Mandeville himself had it, but if we're not in good times and the government can just start spending money, you know, if you're spending, that's a good thing. So I'd have to check. I think that's what the Mandeville fallacy is referring to, but I'd have to check the passage to be sure. I could be remembering that incorrectly. Okay, we still have a few minutes left. If anyone has anything more, well, we have a few minutes left even if somebody doesn't. Oh, I see somebody does. Leslie says, what would government taxes and spending come in under Ricardo's income equation? Well, those would just be deductions from income. I mean, they would be taken out of either rent, wages, or profit. They would be just like, you imagine just people taking away money from one of these factories. And once the government spends money, that would just go to the income of the people that they spend it on. So Ricardo takes a negative view of taxes and spending, because that's just taking away what other people have produced. It's not productive. But you can see they would just be exactions on factory production, and when government spending would just go to either rent, wages, or profit, depending on who gets it. Steve says, can you clarify the difference between a purely arbitrary axiom such as Ricardo and a real-world axiom such as an Austrian economics? Well, supposing, say, you say people act, and then we say, what are the properties of action? So that would be a real-world action that people really do act, but when you say, as Ricardo did, the landlord always gets the total gain from land of higher productivity, all the gains from total land of higher productivity. But it's just an assumption he's introduced. He doesn't really show that it's true. It's kind of just an axiom he's put in and doesn't really show why we have to accept it. So now the equation he has, total income equals rent plus wages and profits, is not arbitrary, but the problem there isn't considering really causal relations between rent, interest, and profit. He's just saying, well, they're identical. You have this identity. Total income equals that, so then if you hold certain ones constant, others will have to change if the identity should be preserved. But what's arbitrary is assuming that rent is fixed. So then that would be example something arbitrary. Rent is fixed, so then changes in wages rise, and this has to come at the expense of profit. That would be an example of an arbitrary. Well, does anyone have any last question? I think we're out of time. Oh, wait. use as the one based on experience by telling the car is accident or not. Yes, that's basically correct. I mean, we see necessary features of experience in praxeology. That's a very good point. You're right. You also, that's a good point, you also spotted that misprint of casual for causal. Now, Michael said accidents are inductive. Well, they're not inductive in the sense that they're derived by just looking at different instances and then thinking, generalizing kind of standard inductive logic, but they apply to experience. They were immediately grasped in experience. They're based on certain, they sort of receive that they're necessary to apply, and they apply to experience. Now, advancing the assumption also reduce either reflect real situations or are used to contrast with real situations. Yes, I think that's right. I mean, they're not just arbitrary constructions just designed for mathematical convenience. Okay, well, thanks everybody. So we'll hope to see you all next week. Thanks a lot. Thank you. See you next week, everybody.